Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, come back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Sherry B. Ellis. Welcome.
Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes. So I am originally from Chicago. I've been living in Los Angeles for a number of years, and I am an animation associate producer.
All right. So you're from Chicago. How was it growing up? What is your origin story?
Let's see. So I grew up in Chicago in the 70s on the South Side in a neighborhood called Chatham. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a middle class Black family and in a Black neighborhood. I grew up with my parents, my maternal grandmother, and my brother in the same house. And my grandmother moved in when I was born. I still have relatives in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And my mother's side, we had relatives from Gary, Indiana. So mm-hmm. sometimes we would visit them. But we also have reunion cookouts with my father's side of the family mm-hmm. in Chicago. And those were always fun, especially because I always saw that as a little kid, I always saw that as the fun part of the family. my mother's side was a little more buttoned up. Mm-hmm.
I wonder how consistent that is, like, amongst, like, families. Is the dad side usually the fun side? I feel like both my sides of the family are fun, but, you know, growing up, my mom's side was kind of like the religious side, and then my dad's side was like, you know, the hood side. But then, like, as I grow older, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, my mom's side of the family, they could be, you know, funny and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah. I always felt like my father's side was the funnier side.
Mm-hmm. So you said your, like, grandmother moved in when you were born. Were you, like, the oldest, or was it, like, after your brother, you're like, oh, no, we need help, some help?
Yeah, no, I was definitely the baby of the family. Okay. Yeah.
You mentioned your, cookouts. What are some more of your best childhood memories?
Let's see. Well, I grew up in a neighborhood with a lot of older people. So there weren't a lot of kids on my block, but a lot of my time, my playtime was spent, like, sort of knocking on doors and going, can so-and-so come out and play? And yeah. Sometimes they were teenagers, so they were like, oh, I can't right now, Sherry, I got homework, you know. Like, I liked going to school. Even though I was supposed to, I was being pushed to, yeah, you know, in my academics, I really liked hanging out with the class clowns.
Nice.
Some of my favorite memories are just thinking of the silly jokes that they would come up with. Mm-hmm. My father was a jazz musician, so on Saturdays I would help him. He was a big band musician, so I would help him set up his stands mm-hmm. in downtown at hotels around downtown. Mm-hmm. So that was a big memory. I liked going to the Museum of Science and Industry. Love that. Mm-hmm. And going to the Art Institute. Also, I had the privilege of actually going to France when I was in sixth grade. It was an exchange program to mm-hmm. basically help get Black kids to go abroad when they might not have otherwise had a chance to. That kind of backfired because we ended up with a group of white kids that weren't told that we were all going to be Black. So there was some tension.
Yeah.
but I do have memories, good memories of being there. And
yeah. And like, just, how long were you all there?
We were there a month.
Oh, nice.
And we went to we basically went to the Alps mm-hmm. and studied French, skied, although mm-hmm. I never really learned to ski. I did what's called the pizza, you know, just yeah. and then we spent a weekend in Paris. Mm-hmm. So nice. I think, you know, so yeah, so that definitely, you know, set me on my my wanderlust, basically. So. Mm-hmm.
What is your cultural makeup? And that's not to say what's your ethnicity, but what is the culture of where you grew up and the uniqueness of where you're from?
Let's see, cultural makeup. Well, like I said, I grew up in a middle class background. Kind of fluidly sometimes because my father was a jazz musician. my mother was an assistant principal on the South Side. And so they bought the house we lived in the 50s during the white flight of the South Side. And some people thought we were rich because of it, but like we weren't. Like I've been told that sometimes they weren't sure they're going to be able to keep the house. So but they did a good job of sort of buffering me from that. So I didn't grow up with as much of an awareness of those issues. And my mother was very protective. Mm-hmm. Extremely protective. Full disclosure, I actually had a sister who died before I was born. Mm-hmm. Basically, she didn't get enough oxygen to the brain. And I think that, losing a child just made it so my mom was extremely protective. So when I, like, for instance, when I went out on my bike, I was literally given a 3-house radius to like bike and just basically go back and forth. I challenged that all the time, but which was kind of good. Cause if I had, if I had just grown up just sheltered without ever like pushing those boundaries, then it would have been a lot harder to adjust, as I got older. But like, basically my mom would come out every half hour to check on me. And during that half hour, I would race off to the nearest park and then make sure I was back before the half hour was over.
Nice. Smart. Strategic. Yeah. What is like a favorite, like maybe custom or tradition from like growing up that you had?
Let's see. Besides the cookouts, I would say preparing for Christmas, setting up the tree. We had a little musical box manger that I just loved that played Silent Night. And I can still hear it in my head to this day. And I would say, let me see. Christmas was just a magical time because of all the animated specials that would come out. I had this one in particular. It was the night before Christmas that a lot of people don't remember, but it was made by Rankin Bass, but it wasn't stop motion. It was a 2D animated special. And basically I describe it to people as the Bucktooth Mice special.
Right.
Because that was the main thing that stood out. But it had this like beautiful song. Music was always important to me from the very beginning, just growing up with a musical family. I always, for me, Christmas and music are just intertwined.
So can you get into like, I know you're in production, but like, what is your childhood journey in art and animation and that love for that?
Well, I can't draw to save my life, but I certainly tried when I was, I took art classes and I would draw all the time. And I remember people begging me to stop making portraits of them. Like, that's how bad I was, but I just loved doing it. It definitely wasn't encouraged. So, eventually I stopped, but I started writing when I was a kid, and I think, and I wrote my first novella in fourth grade, just a little handwritten with some like stick figure drawings. I think some of that might have actually had to do with Judy Blume. I recently watched the documentary on her, and it reminded me that I think when I started reading her books, that's when I started writing. Around fourth grade. And let's see, my writing, oddly enough, I think of myself, I have to call myself an 8-year-old goth, because I started reading Edgar Allan Poe, like some other kid turned me on to him, and oddly enough, and so I started writing like pretty like sort of dark stuff. Like the novella that I wrote was about a family that the parents had died in a car accident, and it wasn't like I was trying to kill off my parents or anything like that. It just, I just think for some reason there was something that drama just really spoke to me,
right?
And I think that had to do with, you know, being a kid in a neighborhood where with a lot of older adults. I think I just felt lonely, and so I think that that sort of gothic element just spoke to me. You know, I thought of when I was in my room, almost like a woman in a tower, you know, by yourself. And, but I remember my mom not being happy with that, that aspect of that book. So,
I mean, it was apropos. I feel like a lot of like Disney and child movies don't have parents. Like I remember watching Frozen, and obviously I had to be like multitasking and obviously not paying attention because I miss the parents dying. And so fast forward, I'm like, where are their parents?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, they're dead. Oops.
Right. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was definitely not encouraged to watch like Disney movies. I my mom being an assistant principal, I think she thought that they would like rot my brain or something, which is so weird. And that actually, that triggers another part of a memory of growing up, because my mom, even though my father was a jazz musician, my mom basically forced me to only listen to classical music when I was a kid. You know, so like if I turned on the radio and there was pop music on, I would hear my mom go, that better be classical music you're listening to. I'm like, oh, okay. And I think, you know, so she, you know, she, I think like, I've met other people my age who also were forced to listen to classical music. And I think like an article or a book must have gone around that said like pop, you know, rock music is going to rot your kids' brains. Yeah. And so are Disney movies. So don't let them on that. So yeah. So my parts of my childhood were very regimented.
Yeah. So you attended Yale University, you studied psychology and philosophy in school. Did you originally want a different career path? And like, how did you get into animation?
I know. I was originally going to go into, I had a lot of different dreams as a kid. I was originally, I wanted to be a painter, but then of course not being able to draw a thing kind of pushed that aside. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to be a psychiatric pediatrician. Okay. At one point. And then by high school, I decided I wanted to follow in my mom's footsteps, but go into education policy because I wanted to be a reformer. Mm-hmm. And Yale doesn't have an education degree per se. So I decided, okay, I'll study psychology and philosophy and then go to grad school for education. But I think, you know, the thing is when you're being encouraged to go in a different, in a certain direction, you know, my mom definitely wanted me to go into, basically a fallback type of career. Definitely I was not encouraged to go into music or anything. Neither parent, encouraged that in me. When you're encouraged to do something that's not what you originally wanted to do as a kid, I think you either eventually rebel or you stick to it and you become miserable.
Yeah.
Or you do it and become miserable and then you rebel in the end anyway. And I do remember having a conversation with the dean of the African American Cultural Center at Yale, and he was like, "What do you think you want to do?" And I said, "I could see myself doing something in animation." And it was so out of the blue, like it kind of surprised us both. Like, take. And one of the reasons, you know, besides watching those Rankin Bass specials, was every morning while my mother was braiding my hair, I would watch this show called Star Blazers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, or Space Cruiser Yamato is where it, is how it was released elsewhere. But mm-hmm. But basically, you know, there are these anime shows that I was exposed to very early. Speed Racer, Star Blazers, and Battle of the Planets, mm-hmm. Or Gatchaman, that I fell in love with. Mm-hmm. And particularly with Star Blazers, you know, it was nothing like any other show that I was watching. You know, I would come home and watch Tom and Jerry and Woody Woodpecker and all that, and then I would watch the Saturday morning cartoons. But this one had a serialized story.
Yeah.
And it was romantic, you know, in all senses of the word, mm-hmm. you know, and had drama and high stakes. And my mother and I would watch this, and I was just captivated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably planted the seeds in wanting to do something, just knowing that I could do something that was slightly different.
Yeah.
From what I normally was watching. And then also I watched the Beatles cartoon when I was a kid. Like, a lot of people don't remember this, but there was actually a Saturday morning Beatles cartoon
mm-hmm.
that was run in reruns. It's not Yellow Submarine. It was just this really crappy looking, like, very cheaply made Beatles cartoon. But that and that was how I basically discovered rock music.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was like, "You're only listening to classical music," but then all of a sudden I stumbled on this cartoon. And then I was like, "Who are the Beatles?" And he was like, "Oh no, you know." So basically animation shaped a lot of my life. And so even though it was kind of surprising that in college I was thinking, well, maybe I'll do something in this, it kind of wasn't.
Yeah.
It was definitely in my DNA by then. And then when junior year or senior year, mm-hmm. Edward Scissorhands came out.
Mm-hmm.
And that just changed everything.
I just watched that again like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, God,
I actually have a necklace like Edward Scissorhands.
Oh, do you?
Necklace, yeah.
Yeah, I've got an Edward Scissorhands watch. I have a few items. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that just changed everything. I started reading up on Tim Burton and I just decided I wanted to work for him
mm-hmm.
and somehow. And the funny thing, I started subscribing to like Premiere Magazine and Movie Line, and I was just devouring those and reading about the industry. And I realized that, you know, I didn't want to be like Tim Burton. I wanted to be like his producer, Denise DeNovi.
Okay.
And, you know, I decided early on, if I do this, I want to be a movie producer eventually. And mm-hmm. So I invited Tim Burton to come speak at Yale. And he didn't, but because he was working on Batman Returns, he had other things to do, obviously. But
yeah.
As a result, I kept in touch with his office
mm-hmm.
and developed a relationship with them. I went to visit them during spring break and interviewed mm-hmm. with them. And when I went to grad school, I just kept in touch, sent them letters telling them about my progress. And then a PA position on Ed Wood opened. So the production manager called me and interviewed me and offered me the job on the spot. And so I left grad school and moved out to LA.
Nice. Yeah. So, so Yale is in Connecticut. So how did you break free of your chains from your childhood? Like, did your mom let you go because it was like Yale, or like and did you decide, 'cause I'm like, oh, I'm out, like I'm leaving.
Well, funny enough, and this was just, you know, I think this happens to a lot of overachieving kids. My mom, when I was very young, when I was like 6 or 7, would tell people, well, Sherry's either going to Yale or Harvard, and then she's going to Oxford or Cambridge for grad school. It was just like, wow, no pressure or anything. So So yeah, so it was, so even though my mom was overprotective, she definitely had high hopes for me.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she passed away when I was 12. Okay. She died of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And she was only 52 at the time. Mm-hmm. And, but you know, she had planted that Ivy League seed in me. And out of all of the Ivy League colleges, I wanted to go to a liberal one. Mm-hmm. I had gone to a really stifling Catholic high school and I wanted to go to the exact opposite.
Yeah.
So it came down to either Brown or Yale, and Brown, I needed a little more structure than Brown was offering. Cause I think with Brown, you know, I don't know if it's still like this, but you know, you could choose your own major. And I was just like, yeah, I need just a little, I need to be told just a little bit more what to do. So, yeah. So I chose Yale, and that ended up being incredible because, I already had high expectations for going there, but I discovered an a cappella music community there.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined a group, and then I went, and then, I also did the Yale Glee Club.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up far exceeding my expectations because I didn't, I didn't expect this musical aspect to be part of my experience.
Yeah.
So I think because I was already, you know, it was definitely in me that even though I was focusing on my studies, I still wanted to do something creative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was still very important to me. So I think, that through line has always been there, you know.
So you were part of, you know, Yale Glee Club and Out of the Blue, like,
mm-hmm.
did you grow up singing, or, and was it because of the musical influence of your father? Like, how did you decide to get into music?
I was always singing. Like, I was always singing with the church. Mm-hmm. And I would do solos for my church and for our neighborhood block parties. Mm-hmm. I was, despite the whole classical music thing, I had somehow managed to sneak the Carpenters into my listening regimen. So I would spend hours in our basement, like listening to Carpenters albums and trying to blend with Karen's voice,
mm-hmm.
and get my voice to sound like hers. So, and then when I was, when my father would drive me to school, we would listen to Lou Rawls.
Okay.
So, and Johnny Mathis. So I was definitely, I was getting a little bit, and also my brother would blast whatever music. For some reason, he wasn't told he had to listen to classical music. So I was hearing R&B from him.
Mm-hmm.
So there was definitely like little influences that were seeping in. There weren't really opportunity. There wasn't like a choir at my high school, but I ended up joining the church choir, which was great because it ended up just being a big social thing with other kids my age.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to college, it was definitely like, just something exploded in me because like I said, I definitely wasn't encouraged to go into music. In fact, quite the opposite. I had talked to my father about maybe I want to be a singer. Maybe that's what I want to do. And so I think he did this by design. He brought, I don't think he wanted me to, you know, go into the family business. So he invited one of his backup singers to come and hear me sing. And she basically said, well, your singing style is really dated. And it was just like she didn't say I sung badly or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I think she was, I kind of feel like she was maybe told
a plant.
Yeah, to give me a sort of a discouraging review. Mm-hmm. So when I went to college, I sang, because I've been listening to Lou Rawls, for all my auditions, I sang Lou Rawls' version of Unforgettable.
Mm-hmm.
And people loved it. And mm-hmm. so that was the first time that I had ever gotten a taste of like, oh, people actually think my voice sounds good. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I joined the a cappella group. I quit after about a year, but it was long enough for that I'm considered like a lifelong member of the group. But I stayed in the Yale Glee Club, and it turned out a lot of the out of the blue people were also in the Yale Glee Club because the pitch that the which is the name of the musical director of Out of the Blue was the assistant conductor for Yale Glee Club. So it kind of you know, it just all made sense for us all to just stick together.
So what led to your Duran Duran obsession?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's so funny. Oh, of course we had to go there.
Yes.
So by around, I guess, like 84, I had finally just stopped listening to classical music. I do, and I don't want to diss it. I still listen to 20th century classical music in particular, but by the 80s, like, you know, the Jacksons, I'd heard, and just MTV, you know, we had to wait for so long on the South Side of Chicago to get MTV that it just held this like, this aura of mystery around it, because it was like this big political battle over who was going to bring cable to the South Side. So by the time we got it, you know, we kids like me were hungry for it.
Yeah.
And you know, by then I knew about Duran, but I hadn't yet gotten into them. But there were some girls at my school who were really into Duran, and they had shirts made that had their name on the front and the name of their favorite member on the back. And I remember really liking the Reflex and dancing around. And I just loved the part where Simon Le Bon like jumped off the stage, and you know, and I remember doing that off my bed and doing the same thing. But it wasn't until 85 that they released View to a Kill, which was their James Bond song. And I saw the video for that, and I saw Nick Rhodes, who's the keyboardist, and I was like, oh my gosh, he's the most beautiful man in the world. So that just started the whole like, okay, not only do I like their music, like they're beautiful. And so that started that whole obsession. And I started like sort of writing stories in my head, and I didn't know any other fans at the time yet. The Duran Duran fans, they call themselves Duranis. And I didn't yet know any Duranis. So I spent like maybe 6 months kind of just being a rogue fan until, but I was wearing a button of Nick Rhodes, and I wore it at high school. And a girl came up to me and said, hey, I want to talk to you after school. Okay. All right. Whatever. And we've caught up with each other. And she said, so I saw your button. Are you a Durani? And I was like, there's a name for this, you know? And she was black. And
so, okay.
Like I had grown up like being made fun of for my music interests and the way I spoke. And to finally meet someone who had like very similar musical tastes, who looked like me, was just like, oh my gosh, you know, and on top of that, she brought friends with her. So, you know, there's like a whole group of Duranis, black Duranis who lived on the South Side. And so I was brought into the group, and it was the first time that I really felt like I was a part of a social circle. You know, when I met this girl, she was already writing fanfic about Duran, and I was telling her about these stories, but I think I was positing them as dreams. I didn't want to admit that they were just stories I was making up in my head. And she's like, so these dreams, you know, what if you wrote them down? And I was like, oh yeah, why don't I get back into writing like I used to? So that was so fan fiction was basically how I like really honed in my skill, showing that to people sometimes, you know, and eventually like sharing it via email with people. But yeah, that yeah, that's how the whole Duran thing got started. And they ended up being so important to me because I was having such a tough adolescence, just, you know, like I mentioned, my mom had passed away. You know, without going into gory detail, my father had become abusive, first emotionally and then physically. And on top of that, my high school was racist. And so it's like, I would go to school and there and, you know, deal with the stress there. And then I would go home and there'd just be no respite. And so it just, you know, it got to a point where I was just like, oh, just hang on, you know, just hanging on to my, first of all, my dream of getting into Yale. Like that was like, you know, that was the distant light at the end of the tunnel, but also like going to my first Duran Duran concert. Like that was, I was just like, just hang on until then, you know? And so I can literally say that Duran Duran saved my life. You know, it was just like, you know, it's just, it ended up being so magical. Not just the concert, but also I ended up getting into the elevator with them, like at the hotel, like just by, just complete, completely by chance. And, you know, we knew where they were staying, but, and it was actually because I used to help my father set up his stands that I knew where they were staying, but getting into the elevator was just like, we were just kind of standing there and the tour manager was like, well, climb in, ladies. And I think it was because we were Black that he didn't think we were fans. So, you know, it was just this whole, like I said, just this whole magical aura around that whole week. Of them being in Chicago and seeing them and meeting them actually for the second time, but yeah, it just I think that just let me know, like, you know, there's more adventures coming up for you if you just hang on, you know.
This is the part where I list some projects that you've worked on, just so people out there know, you know, somebody who looks like me worked on some things that I watch. And so sometimes IMDb is wrong, so just let me know. But The Proud Family, Beowulf, Beowulf, I Am Legend, G-Force, Alice in Wonderland, Green Lantern, Agent Carter, Rainbow Rangers, Llama Llama, Samurai Rabbit, The Usagi Chronicles, and are there any more?
I worked on Atlantis, and that was when I was at Disney. So after I worked for Tim Burton for a couple of years, I met his producer on Nightmare Before Christmas. And became her executive assistant. And then that led to a production job on Atlantis. And I worked on a couple other Disney movies after that, including one that has never, that will never see the light of day, unfortunately. But that was how I got into animation. And unfortunately, I was part of a layoff at Disney. So I moved on. But then I got the job on the original Proud Family, which was amazing because that was the first time I'd been on a job where, you know, many, if not most of the people on it were Black. That ended up being a turning point for me, not only career wise, but also on a personal basis, because as I mentioned, when I was a kid, I actually got bullied for the way that I spoke and the music I listened to. And someone on the Proud Family, one of my coworkers, made a joke about the way I speak. And I pulled her aside afterwards. And I said, you know, that's really hurtful. I've been dealing with that my entire life. And, you know, I don't think I'm better than anyone. It's just this is the way that I was trained to speak. And you know, and she apologized, and it was just a really powerful moment for me. So I just, you know, I just learned, well, I learned to speak up for myself, one, but also it's just also to not, like, previous, prior to that, I had just assumed that I was always going to be rejected if I was around a group of Black people. And after that, I just learned, you know, even if you are, deal with it, you know. Mm-hmm. It says more about them than it does about me. And,
yeah.
You know, and sometimes, you know, like as in that particular situation, sometimes if I just speak up for myself, you know, there we can come to an understanding.
Yeah.
So that was, I'm always grateful for that moment. But it's funny you mention I Am Legend, because that's the mm-hmm. one project that my family seems to get. Like I'll mention animation and all this, and they're like, what is it you do? I don't understand. And then they're like, oh, you know, Sherry worked on I Am Legend. And it's like, because it's a Will Smith movie. So it's
got, right.
Like,
yeah.
The one thing that
that's the connection.
Like, yeah. There's a connection.
They got to grab onto something.
Yeah.
Why do you feel like you had to go back to being a production coordinator after being a production supervisor at Hyperion? Like,
well, interestingly, with being a production supervisor on Proud Family, I'm not actually credited as production supervisor. The woman who was production supervisor moved to Canada, and then mm-hmm. I was moved into that position, but they didn't want to pay me for it, basically. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I even signed an email, you know, Sherry Biel as production supervisor. And they're like, who told you you could do that? And I was like, you put me in this position. And they're like, well, no, we can't pay you. So just, you have to keep calling yourself a production coordinator right now. And, you know, and they said, you can put it on your resume later that you were. So it's just, but yeah, so technically I was still a coordinator, and that's what I got hired on for my next position. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately I got stuck in coordinator hell for a number of years.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, in the grand scheme of my career, it's kind of been relatively recent that I finally moved up from there.
Yeah.
I think it was 2017. Yeah. 2017, I became a production manager.
Mm-hmm.
And worked at Genius Brands as a production manager. And then I was a production manager on Samurai Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year I was promoted to associate producer. So yay. Nice. Finally got the word. But yeah, it took way too long. And that's, yeah. And one of my regrets is that I allowed that, mm-hmm. it, you know, to a certain extent, it, you know, it's two things. It's when I didn't have an opportunity to, mm-hmm. I wasn't, you know, despite the fact that I kept saying, you know, I'd like to be an APM, like, what do I have to do to become an APM? And then I would be told what to do. And then I did those things, mm-hmm. but then for whatever reason, I was still, you know, some kind of excuse, like,
yeah,
well, you need to have more confidence, you know, or something, you know, for,
yeah.
And I was very shy. I still am.
Mm-hmm.
But I really should have pushed through it. And it's one of the things I tell my mentees, is mm-hmm. that they really, if they're shy, they really need to push through that, because shyness can lead to limited opportunities.
Yeah.
And if I had pushed myself at the time more, mm-hmm. I would have networked more and possibly, you know, had more opportunities to move on sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I definitely remember you at the 2020 Wonen Animation Virtual Summit at Fantasy. You were talking about that, the intersectionality and solidarity panel. You were talking about your struggles of getting into leadership.
Yeah.
So it was the key, like the networking and just breaking out of the shell.
I think for sure that had a lot to do with it. I took a class back in 2017 about career. It was a career coaching and networking class.
Mm-hmm.
And that taught me to know my value, to be mm-hmm. very clear on that, and to not see it as bragging.
Yeah, you know,
that's one thing. I think especially as women, we tend to mistake just being upfront about our accomplishments as bragging.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, men are just taught that they should just do it. Just mm-hmm. put themselves there. and not attach, you know, a value judgment to it. Mm-hmm. And I think things really turned for me once I took that class. Just a little plug, Sandra Lord is the one who did it. So definitely recommend her class.
Yeah. I was in a group when I lived in New Orleans. I was in a women in technology group, and there was a lot of talk about that, like particularly, you know, sometimes as women, we may even do, because you said you did exactly what they said, but sometimes we might think we're doing something that is doing something as a leader, but it's actually not. I remember one woman told a story about, like, you know, whether it was like bringing, you know, baked goods or like just helping people, but like, or, you know, going to visit people, but they're like, oh, but we still don't see you as a leader because you're like doing these things, but you're not actually doing leadership things. Mm. It's like you're being nice, but being nice doesn't make you a leader.
Right.
So yeah, sometimes we have to get more direction, and then sometimes even when we do it, you know.
Yeah, to be honest, at the time that I left the company, to become a photographer, and at that time, a lot of Black people were being let go. So I have to say, it wasn't, you know, it definitely me and perhaps my lack of confidence had something to do with it. But I also think that we just weren't being seen as potential leaders, you know? I think there was an unacknowledged racism that was going on, you know. Yeah. I'll stress unacknowledged. I definitely don't think anyone was going around saying, you know, blah, 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 no, Black people aren't ready to be, but no.
The unconscious bias.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So when did you get into photography, and like, how was that, quitting to pursue photography?
So I was always taking photos when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I would walk around in high school. I carried a Kodak disc camera. There's a special place in hell for the person who created a Kodak disc, because the negatives literally look like a disc and you can't process them anywhere now. So, but back in the 80s, I would just go around taking photos with those. So I think it was, I always had an interest, and I would... I would put these posters of Duran Duran all over my bedroom walls, but I wasn't just looking at, at the person in them. I was looking at the lighting, and I was very picky about what pictures I put on. I would art direct my room. Like I would have like, oh, the pastels need to be here. And then the blacks and the reds need to be over here, and the blues over here. I wouldn't buy any cheap magazines. You know, I like the pages had to be in glossy full color. Mm-hmm. So I think that I always had a photographer's eye when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I just needed a little training.
Yeah.
And I started, the way I got into photography as an adult is I was volunteering for Obama, and I, back in 2008, and I took a photo of a child's drawing, and it ended up in Time magazine because I had hashtagged it, and this was the early days of hashtagging, and where they could actually still find things. And so it ended up in a 2-page spread in Time magazine, and as a result, I was like, wow, if Time magazine is interested in something that that I take, maybe this is something I could do as a career. And that happened to go with, you know, at the time, not having a hard time getting promoted. Mm-hmm. So I was getting disillusioned anyway, and also just really wanting to do something creative. Mm-hmm. So I started taking classes at night. And then I decided to enroll in the full-time photography program at Santa Monica College. And it just happened that there wasn't really anything for me to roll onto, another project for me to roll onto anyway. So I was like, well, I'm just going to enroll finally. And so I graduated. I started my own production company. I was assisting as a photographer. And I really enjoyed that for a while. Mm-hmm. But I ended, and it was great because in one way, because it really developed my confidence as a creative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had to troubleshoot, you know, lighting issues and I, you know, it just gave me the confidence to know like, oh, okay, I don't only have to do production management for a living. Maybe I could do something more creative.
Yeah.
The thing I did find out though, particularly as a photography assistant, is that the photography business is one of the most sexist industries. Mm-hmm. And I kind of was like, well, if I'm going to deal with that, I should get paid a little better. So
yeah.
And that realization coincided with me going to Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to Comic-Con every year, but this particular year, I sat in on an adult animation block and I started thinking about a project that I had had for many years called Fangirl.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I got to get back into animation so I can make that a reality.
Yeah.
So I started looking for jobs in animation again. I ended up working on Agent Carter as a sort of, it was sort of a transitional job because it wasn't animation, but it was visual effects, mm-hmm. which I already, you know, already had experience in. And then that led to my working at Bento Box. So, mm-hmm. and I've been working in animation again ever since.
What would you say is the thing that people most misunderstand about you?
I think because of my shyness, maybe people take that to mean, you know, one of the things that we were taught in that career coaching class that I took was mm-hmm. that shyness can sometimes be taken as snobbery.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe that's one of the problems that I might run up against.
I think I actually came naturally, I mean, only in the past, you know, 4 years or so to the mm-hmm. snobbery thing because for me, like, I never identified as shy. I was always quiet, but I also had this thing where I didn't think people remembered me. Mm. And so I remember, you know, being involved in the National Urban League movement and I would go to conferences and because I didn't think people remembered me, I wouldn't like be like, oh, hey, person I've met before. I just would be like, oh, they don't remember me. And so it probably came off as I was a B word because I wasn't saying hi to them, but it was I just don't think you remember me.
Right.
And so,
okay.
I could see the snobbery thing of like, oh, I am not important. So I'm not going to say hi to this person that I met last year or maybe even the year before.
Right.
And they're
right.
Like, oh, why is she being mean? And I'm like, I am actually not being mean. I'm being insecure.
Right. Yeah. 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 Kind of the opposite.
Yeah. So I came to that of like the negative misinterpretation of your own insecurities.
Mm. I think actually another thing just came to me. I think some people, well, especially when I was younger, I think some people thought that I was too serious and too mm-hmm. sensitive. I think I've kind of made up for that by now, but I have been told, particularly in the past, that that sometimes I intimidate people.
That never makes sense. Because, like, even when I was, like, not as sure of myself in high school and stuff like that, it's like, what is intimidating about me? Like, I don't talk. Like,
right. And I guess some people just, the not talking, being shy thing, they come up
mysterious.
With.
Yeah.
Yes, the mysterious, a bunch of, just a whole narrative in their head about that you're silently judging them or something.
But what's hilarious is that, like, because I've had this dichotomy of like, you know, some people when they first meet me, like, oh, you're the first person to talk to me, or other people are like, oh, I thought you were like rude. And so sometimes the people who thought I was rude is like they look at me from afar don't decide to converse with me and then decide I'm rude because I don't converse with them, which makes no sense. Like, it's not like you talked to me and I was rude. You just didn't talk to me and then assumed that I was rude.
Right, right.
You don't think it's rude to assume that. So good times, good times.
Yeah. And sorry, I knew my cat was going to show at some point. This is Zora. She's named after Zora Neale Hurston.
Nice. That's one of my sorority sisters. She was a Zeta.
Oh.
So you have extensive experience in volunteering for various organizations, and you've like consulted as well. Like, what does volunteering provide for you? And like, you know, you've consulted for the character Chavez on BoJack Horseman and Elijah on Big Mouth. What do these opportunities mean to you?
Well, for those who don't know, I am asexual,
mm-hmm.
and I co-run a group called Ace Los Angeles, mm-hmm. which is a social meetup and educational group for mm-hmm. asexuals and aromantics in Los Angeles. And, you know, for me, visibility is important. Because we're a very misunderstood group.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, one of the ways that people find, you know, learn about us is going to be through media, as you know, they aren't necessarily going to do the research on their own.
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, it's very important that we have characters who represent us, and, you know, the spectrum of us. And
mm-hmm.
so, when for BoJack Horseman, the producers reached out to GLAAD, and GLAAD reached out to one of our more prominent spokespeople, David mm-hmm. Jay, and David Jay reached out to me mm-hmm. and asked if I'd be interested. So I went in and spoke with the staff for mm-hmm. an hour and a half, and they had already done their research, so it was a very painless conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I mostly talked about my personal experiences, but I also talked about what I'd love to see more of in mm-hmm. In ace representation,
mm-hmm.
What I would like to not see ever again. Mm-hmm. And they did a great job listening, you know. So that's one way that that volunteering is just very fulfilling, seeing the result of that one conversation show up time and time again throughout the seasons on BoJack Horseman.
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing how well they did on Big Mouth as well. With Big Mouth, they also sent us the scripts, the animatics, they had us sit in on table reads. So we were very involved in, mm-hmm. You know, in the writing, at the writing stages of, mm-hmm. Of those episodes. So, it's extremely rewarding, to see, you know, to see our efforts, actually be incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, I also volunteer, I have volunteered for Inner City Arts as an mm-hmm. animation assistant.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have classes on Saturdays, and one of them was in animation. So mm-hmm. I used to help out with that class, and you know, these kids, they saw me as a mentor. I mean, one mm-hmm. kid actually said, "I'm so happy to be that you're my mentor." you know, and you know, there aren't that many Black people in animation in the grand scheme of it. So mm-hmm. you know, for them to see that someone who's in the industry, who's stuck with the industry, mm-hmm. You know, that will definitely stick with them. And, you know, I'm really proud to have been a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like sometimes when, you know, I guess closed-minded people talk about all the labels that exist, and I'm like, the labels are so people can find community and, like, at the very least, Google search what they're going through. And it's like, oh, no, first of all, I'm not alone, and this is what this is. Like,
right.
You don't have to learn all the labels. They're not for you. Like, they're for the people that they who need them.
Right, right, right. Right, exactly.
So can you talk more about Fangirl and you know, what's been going on with that?
Yeah, so Fangirl is my baby. I've written a couple of animated scripts by now, one called Furries, which is about furries, and and then Fangirl, and they're both adult animated. They're meant for adult audiences. And not to say that I write raunchy or anything like that, but they definitely, deal with adult themes. And in the case of Fangirl, it's about a woman in her 40s who's a record company executive who discovers that she's inherited the powers of a muse. So she has the ability to ignite creativity in musicians. And she needs to save music from disappearing forever at the hands of a menace with the ability to steal creativity. So I got the idea originally for a superhero fan years ago, just from observing different fans, but I kind of had like sort of vignette-y ideas, like, oh, they could do this and she could do this and she could do this, but I didn't have a narrative in my head. So when I was at Bento Box, they actually sponsored writing classes, art classes. So I took a story structure class, and that's where I came up with the idea that I could tie Fangirl into the story of my career, into the story of my struggle to become a leader, because Fran, the main character, who's also Fangirl, she also struggles in her music career, working at Boombox Records. And then I could also tie it to the story of my family, because Fran's grandmother is also a muse. Basically, the power gets passed down through the women in her family. So she's very close to her grandmother, as I was close to my grandmother, and her grandmother, guides her as she learns how to harness her powers. So I wrote the first script in 2017, and I've been rewriting it, since, because I try to be good about taking notes and accepting feedback. And that's obviously it's a skill that I had to build up, because sometimes I would get feedback at the very beginning, and I'd be like, I don't know what to do with this. Luckily, I'm in a couple of great writing groups. I'm in the my college, the LA chapter of my college alumni group has a writers group for women. And then I also belong to another group of predominantly that's predominantly Black women called Happy Place, and they're both incredibly supportive. I get different kinds of feedback from both groups, so it's good, because then I learn what different how my script is being perceived by different audiences. I've entered it into contest, and it's placed. And again, I always ask for the feedback, because I always want to know how it's being perceived and what I can do to improve it. Most recently, it placed as semifinalist in the CineStory TV Writing Retreat Fellowship. So I just this past month, I went on the CineStory TV Retreat. Which was just an incredible experience, just being mentored and meeting such incredible writers, and being inspired, and being mentored one-on-one about my scripts, because I asked for both to get feedback on both Fangirl and Furries, and people have described that a CineStory is life-changing, and I know why now. So I've been entering in contests. I have also pitched Fangirl to a company, and so that was another great experience of getting feedback. It actually did pretty well. Like it got to the next level and before they ultimately passed. But but it was a great experience because also not only for the feedback they gave me, but they also said, you know, they want to keep in touch with me. They wanted me to, they said, if you have anything else you want to pitch to us, please do. And they want to keep me in mind for staffing positions. Nice. So, you know, so it's definitely a lesson that even if your project doesn't move forward, it's a relationship to that you can build.
Yeah.
And I've definitely kept in touch with them.
I feel like in all your stories, like 2017 comes up a lot. Like, I feel like that was like a monumental year for you. Do you feel that?
Yeah. Yeah. I do. I do. I do. Which I guess just says I was ready for change. You know, there have been certain other years, like 2008 to 2009 was a big year for me, where I and I'll get to that in a second. But like 2017 was definitely a huge year in terms of personal growth. Mm-hmm. So 2008, I think that was when that was during the elections when Obama and Hillary were running, and I just. It was a huge year in terms of, well, I learned a lot about my friends, about the ones who really wanted to keep it real and who didn't.
Yeah.
I gained some friends who are, you know, who are lifelong friends, and I lost a few. Mm-hmm. And I think it was definitely a year where I decided I just wanted to push myself because I think, you know, I was stagnating at I felt like I was stagnating at the company where I was. And the following year in 2009, I ended up entering like an informal contest to sing a duet with the opening act of Tears for Fears. And I ended up winning.
Nice.
And so like one night, like basically the opening act wanted to sing a duet in different cities. So I won for Santa Rosa, here in Northern California. And so I sang, before Tears for Fears went on, I sang before an audience of 1400 people. So it got me back into my singing.
Yeah.
And it was, and I literally did it to scare myself. You know, I was just like, if I can do this, then I can do anything.
Yeah. What do you hope for the future of animation as far as innovation, storylines, characters, etc.?
Well, I definitely want to see more representation, more diverse representation. I want to see more, I want to see more Black women. I want to see, particularly, I want to see more Black women in, you know, above the age of 40, 50. Mm-hmm. I want to see ace characters. Mm-hmm. I want to see more queer characters in general. Mm-hmm. I want to see characters with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Not just in children's animation. I want to see it in adult animation as well.
Yeah.
So that's, and I definitely want to see, to make that happen, you know, we definitely need people, more people of color, more people of, from diverse, communities in positions of power.
Yeah.
You know, we need more producers, we need more executives, managers, agents, you know, all aspects.
Yeah.
Making decisions. And also I want to see those of us in the industry keep up with the technology.
Yeah.
I just had a very sobering conversation about AI with a group of producers, and you were talking about how, you know, it's not going away.
Yeah.
So we need to stay ahead of it, you know, so it doesn't control us.
Yeah.
you know, so yeah, so that's definitely, and I need to follow that advice myself, because I've kind of been sort of ignoring it because it's this scary thing I don't want to think about.
Yeah.
But I definitely need to get ahead of it and learn more about it.
As you continue your career in animation, what have you decided is your purpose in regards to Blackness and Black professionals in animation and queerness?
It is very important that in my writing that I represent queer characters and people of color. Fran is Ace. And I have queer, the furries community is very queer friendly. So that's reflected in my script. So it's, you know, it's important that wherever I have a chance that I, that I put forward that kind of representation. As a professional, you know, it's important to mentor people of color and queer people, and I definitely do that. I'm excited. I literally, for the first time, maybe 2 weeks ago, I had a Black woman approach me who wanted to be mentored, and that was the first time. There's just not enough of us, particularly who want to go into production management, side of it. And so that was really exciting to me to have the chance to tell her about my experiences and to give her advice and to keep the door open, to keep in touch.
Yeah. What are three movies you'd recommend my audience watch and why?
Oh boy. Okay. Let me see. Well, my favorite movie, and this is, I don't know if I'm going to actually get anyone to actually watch this, but is My Dinner with Andre. It's a conversation between a couple of white guys in a restaurant. Like I said, I don't know if I'm ever going to like convince anybody to listen, but it's about the conversation. It's about the journey that they take during the conversation. It's about the tension between art and real life. And I feel it deeply, and it's incredible. It's an incredible film that by the time that it makes me laugh, but it also by the time of it, I'm crying. And I think more people definitely need to see it. Animated, I would say Iron Giant. That's just, oh my gosh. I don't know. I don't know if I can do it justice, but that's another one that makes me laugh and cry. And it was, and it was so different when it came out, and I remember telling, because it flopped when it came out, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was still working at Disney, and I met Brad Bird, and I said, I wish we had put out your film. And he said, I wish you did too. Which is a very Brad Bird kind of thing to say. But yeah, just such an amazing film. And let me see, what's the third one? Let me think. Citizen Kane. I'll say Citizen Kane, just as a, I get it. It's kind of, it's one of those that everybody recommends, but it's so incredible. It's so beautiful. As a photographer, I'm in awe of it. I took a cinematography class where we were asked, so what scenes do you want to reproduce? And I said, I want to reproduce the scene. I described the scene, and then we did it. And it was just so incredible to just to think about what they did with the technology that they had at the time.
Yeah.
But the other thing about Citizen Kane is it's funny. Like, this is one of the things, like, I think people think it's like this super serious film, but it is hilarious, like intentionally hilarious. I watched it again last year and it's like, oh my gosh, I love this movie. So yeah, you know, it's just a beautifully crafted film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that'll be my third.
If you could choose an actor to play you in a biopic, who would you pick?
I've been compared to Jill Scott, so I'll go with mm-hmm. that.
Nice. I loved her in what was it? Dang it, it's such a weird name. The first lady detective.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, something ladies detective.
Yeah. Something, yeah. But I wish they had a second season. I like that show.
Yeah.
last question. If someone was producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight about your life outside of your work in animation?
I would like them to highlight, I guess, the struggle to know my value. Mm-hmm. I think that is, you know, I've kind of been, I feel like I've been fighting that my entire life, you know, from childhood on. I remember when I was applying to Yale, I didn't do so well on the SATs because I had just been through so much that I became a bad test taker.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a recruiter come who was, you know, he was encouraging almost all the other kids to apply. And I mentioned my SAT scores and I said, but I'm also, you know, I keep my grades up. I'm involved in different extracurriculars and all that. And I'm thinking of applying early admission. And he was like, well, you might want to rethink that, you know, because with the SAT scores, you know, you might get rejected outright. And I'm so glad I didn't listen to him. Not only did I did not listen to him, and I got in early admission.
Nice.
Partly with an essay on Duran Duran, I might say. I've had a lifelong struggle, not only to know my value, but also to show other people what my value is. So
yeah,
I think that would probably be the message that I'd want to get across.
Nice. So where can people follow you on social media?
They can follow me on LinkedIn. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. On Twitter, I'm O'Sherry, O-H-S-H-A-R-I, like the Steve Perry song, because of course.
Right.
And that's also the name of my website, O'Sherry.com. Mm-hmm. On Instagram, I'm O'Sherry Productions, because there's another 80s woman who like keeps trying to steal the same So I had to settle for O'Sherry Productions, and I even saw a tweet from her where she's like, darn it, someone took the domain. So definitely you can find me either O'Sherry Productions.
So I want to thank you for coming on my platform and allowing me to highlight you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I had fun. Thank you so much. I think what you do is extraordinary.
Thank you. And to everyone out there, I want you to like So I Know It's Real, comment and tell me how you feel, subscribe to Citadel, and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.